It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We talk with the Jeopardy champion from Green Bay, who is back on the quiz show in the Tournament of Champions. But first, northern Wisconsin snow drought has been dramatic this winter. The region's snowfall has been between 20 and 60 inches below averages since November. The lack of snow has been devastating to the state's winter tourism industry, and this winter is on track to become Wisconsin's warmest on record. As Danielle Kading reports, that has forced local businesses and outdoor enthusiasts to adapt.
As the sun shone overhead, blinding white snow blanketed the course at the start of the American Birkebeiner ski race. Temperatures hovered below freezing, and hundreds of skiers and spectators waited for the starting gun at the 50th anniversary of North America's largest cross-country ski race. But if it weren't for artificial snow, it's likely the race would have never happened. Organizers announced in early February that the Berkey would be held on a shorter course and on snow they made themselves.
Pretty amazing that we have no snow otherwise, and they were able to still pull off this race.
That's 44-year-old Ann Nischke of Stevens Point. She cheered on elite skiers as they raced laps on a 10-kilometer course and cable. Nischke skied a shorter race the day before. She says even that was tough.
Well, like this year, I didn't train at all.
She switched to running to train for the race, and so did 18-year-old Laura Johnson of Madison. She was waiting to ski a shorter version of the Berkey. While she's glad the event took place, she says it wasn't the same this year.
Because it's not the full thing, and I really enjoy going into Hayward and finishing up in the middle of the street.
Some skiers say artificial snow made the course icy and difficult to navigate. Others say it created faster conditions and praised organizers for pulling off the race. But 64-year-old Rich Montana of Amory was just glad the event happened at all.
Thank God there's man-made snow.
About a 20-minute drive away in downtown Hayward, people are shopping at businesses like Riverbrook Bike and Ski.
Thank you.
Cindy Smith-Kaner co-owns the shop. She says the lack of snow means ski sales have been almost non-existent, and many businesses are saying revenues are down 75%.
We're just looking ahead. I don't want to dwell on that number. Just think to the future, and I think it makes you be more conservative and diversified.
Hotels, lodges, and restaurants have missed out on customers who usually come up to ski, snowmobile, and ice fish. That's according to Chris Ruckdashel with the Hayward Area Chamber of Commerce. He says some businesses have reported losses of hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's prompted the chamber to promote the use of ATVs instead.
It's helped a lot. It just hasn't completely replaced what otherwise would have been.
Not all businesses say the warm winter is hurting their bottom line.
And then she's going to do a glass of Prosecco.
Caroline Gertis with Three Fly Sisters Taps and Wines says some people have been more willing to get out of their homes with the warmer weather.
You know, despite the no snow, we've been extremely busy. I think because we're not dependent on that snowmobile traffic and we're right in town, everyone's shopping and doing fun things.
At Myers Beach on Lake Superior, ice melts in the midday sun along the shoreline before giving way to open water. A decade ago, almost 150,000 people visited here to see the ice caves within the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. The ice caves haven't been open to the public since 2015. This year, Neil Schrader of Washburn saw the massive ice formations from a kayak.
Big chunks of ice, some 30 feet long, and then little tiny icicles inside the caves and on things, and from the water splashing up against it. It was just a real beautiful, surreal kind of experience.
Schrader has paddled to the caves a couple times this winter, but he warned it's dangerous. An emergency room physician, he says people could die within seconds if they fall in the icy waters. While he enjoys winter paddling, he says the warmer weather has been kind of a bummer.
But, you know, you have to kind of adapt. Go running, go kayaking, do other things.
Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Tournament of Champions is underway on the TV game show Jeopardy. It features 27 top performing contestants from last season, including Green Bay's Ben Chan, who had a 9-game winning streak. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Chan is an assistant professor of philosophy at St. Norbert College in De Pere and a quarterfinalist in the Jeopardy! 2024 Tournament of Champions. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to join you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Okay. So Tournament of Champions underway. How do you feel about your appearance?
I am very excited to finally be able to show America and Green Bay and Wisconsin what I did in LA. Hopefully they find it as entertaining as I did.
I love your choice of words. Like, what are you able to say and not say about the tournament and the results before the program's broadcast?
Well, I'm glad I'm joining you today, because if you watched yesterday's episode is, I think, one of the maybe the greatest upset in Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions history. Ike Barinholtz, who's the first celebrity Jeopardy! Player to play in the Tournament of Champions, pulled off an upset against Ray LaLonde, who had been a 13 game winner, and it was incredible to watch in person, and the internet forums were going crazy about it yesterday.
do you watch yourself on Jeopardy? Do you watch yourself on TV?
Yeah, that's actually the biggest surprise, was that I had dreaded that part of it. Uh-huh. Because, you know, as a lot of people don't like their voice, and then I thought I would not like my voice or my face if I saw myself on TV. But it was, the watch parties were actually probably the most fun I had, because you finally, you know, really you do it for your family and for your community, because that's what brought you there. So that's one that really completes the experience, you know.
I thought you would say you also do it for the philosophers who came before. I mean, is there any is there any philosophical wisdom that can be applied to the game of Jeopardy itself?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. You know, I'm in the middle of writing a chapter for a friend who's putting together an anthology on some related stuff in philosophy. And actually, the best thing is that Tournament of Champions has given me an excuse to go past the original deadline, because I told him, oh, you know, if we wait till the Tournament of Champions is over, I can incorporate all of the wisdom from the Tournament of Champions. So that's been nice.
So what is your advice for preparing to compete on Jeopardy? Do you have any good tips?
Yeah, I think Ken Jennings put it well in one of his pieces. He borrowed this from another contestant, that really the best preparation is a lifetime of paying attention, right? And I think, you know, it's very hard to get on the show, so I wouldn't encourage anybody to study specifically for the show unless they got called. Then you could do some things. But other than that, you know, I think it's watching the show is enjoyable for a lot of people, and including myself, I think, because there's so much that the show covers in 20 minutes, right? And so I'd say actually probably if there's one thing that's most effective in preparing for the show, it's just watching the show.
Hmm. Jeopardy fans say that you clutch the buzzer close to your chest. Is that posture on purpose?
Yeah, it was on purpose. You know, there's a lot of talk, you know, if you search how to prepare for Jeopardy, one of the big things is buzzer anxiety. And so I got a device that I could plug into my computer and play simulated games with before I got on the show. And I think for me, I like that just because I knew then where the buzzer was. And I didn't have to think about it. There are other preferred stances if you look around where, you know, you're holding it down by your waist. But then when I tried that, I lost track of where it was. So I just kept it there, then I knew it was there, and I didn't have to think about it again.
Did you make your own flashcards for preparing? Like, what goes into the flashcards and the studying?
Yeah, I did. You know, they're all made by sort of hand through your phone, which is handy because now, you know, instead of having a deck where you're cycling through them, the flashcard apps will keep track of when you've seen them and how, when you need to see them again, right? So I think, you know, I think in general, performance has gotten better on the show, and it's probably, you know, 50% due to the fact that now we have these flashcard apps that make learning, this kind of learning, more effective. So
AI is squeaking into every little place, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think for people on this very network talk about, you know, kind of like the optimal way to study, right? And yep. I think it's those apps incorporate some of that psychology about the optimal way to study.
Ben Chan is an assistant professor of philosophy at St. Norbert College. We'll see him on Jeopardy today as a quarterfinalist in this year's Tournament of Champions. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You know that music. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in with Ben Chan, who is in the Tournament of Champions on the quiz show Jeopardy. It features dozens of top performing contestants from last season. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Chan is on the philosophy faculty at St. Norbert College and a quarterfinalist in this year's Jeopardy Tournament of Champions. Ben, what happens inside of you when you hear the music?
That's funny. It's good that's a cover rather than the real music. The real music definitely triggers anxiety. I think it's a good kind of nervousness, you know, like the pregame jitters. But every contestant talked about that when the theme song plays, then you're something in your, you know, amygdala kicks in.
It's a trigger. Yeah, it's a trigger. Yeah. What is your approach to staying collected in such a stressful environment, you know, and knowing where your buzzer is? Like, how do you keep it together?
You know, I think actually once the game begins, then it's very freeing. I think actually there's a psychiatrist who's in the tournament, Dr. Zahir, who mentioned that actually for a lot of people with anxiety and other things, Jeopardy is great because it's actually not a lot of thinking. It's all due. There's not enough time to think. And that's, you do all the thinking beforehand. And then once they start firing clues at you, you're just saying things. You're not thinking.
You've talked about how you've wanted to play with joy, and I want to touch on that word joy. What does that mean for Ben Chan to play with joy?
That's a good question. I think it's a bit of, you know, letting go of thinking, as I was just saying, right? That once you're there, you let something else take over, right? Because mm-hmm. You've done everything that you can from a kind of executive function role. Like, you don't have control over it anymore, right? So once you give up that sense of control and trying to control it, right, I think that's in probably all activities, right, what allows you to experience joy, whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk about the misspelling. Jeopardy fans, we gotta go here. You know, so Jeopardy fans on social media say you were robbed of that 10th win when you wrote Benedict from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing instead of Benedict in Final Jeopardy. What do you think about the show's rules on spelling and the outcome of that?
Yeah, I think I talked to some people on the show afterwards, actually when I visited again, and I think, and without getting into a lot of detail, it was a what we would call an edge case, right? That there's pretty clear rules about spelling. There are pretty clear rules about sources. There are pretty clear rules about, you know, other things. And that case just happened to like be a boundary case on three different ways that the rules intersect. So it was a tough case to rule on. And I think that's probably the fundamental part of it, that it's a tough case. Just a tough case to rule on because of it didn't align with the canonical spelling now, but it also was a misspelling that kind of changes pronunciation. And then there's a question of which sources, you know, Shakespeare is complicated to source, mm-hmm. and that threw an extra layer of complexity on it. So it just turns out to be kind of a tough case to adjudicate.
And then in the scheme of the show, it has to happen within seconds. You know, in Final Jeopardy, your answer is there, and then the host is saying the outcome. So it's not like, you know, in sports where the officials go to the sidelines and review the tape.
Yeah, there is a little, you know, there's editing in the show. So there is sometimes, you know, what they call stop downs, where that happens behind the scenes. But even then, you know, there's only so much you can find out so often in 10 or 20 minutes, right? So, and that would probably be the longest they take. So, yeah, it just is a, you know, actually sports is what helped me. I'm a huge sports fan. And so I realized, look, they're, you know, it's, we're not doing scholarship exactly, right, on the show. It is a game. And in sports, sometimes there are rulings that have to be made that are maybe not platonically perfect rulings, mm-hmm. but they have to be ruled that way because otherwise it would open up a can of worms for the game moving forward.
You're a huge sports fan. Who's your team?
Well, it's a complex. I grew up in New York, so I have multiple teams, but I've lived in, you know, Wisconsin for 12 years now. So I have multiple teams. I have to say, I feel sad when the Packers lose, and I also feel sad when the New York Giants lose.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, Green Bay fans have started this online petition that would commission a mural of your face along with the words King of the North. How do you feel about this outpouring of support?
I think it's great. I mean, I'm texting with some of our contestants from TOC right now, and we call this period in between taping and airing Jeopurgatory, right? Because it's, yes. You're in this, right? So we talk a lot, and that's actually part of what makes us so close is we're the only people we can talk, process this with during this Jeopurgatory period. But, you know, one of the things last year that I wasn't sure about was, look, I think I did something cool, but I'm not sure if anybody will care. And it was important to me to represent, you know, our area well. So I was really, that was one of the things that I was, you know, preoccupied with, is anybody going to notice? And it was really heartwarming to see that people noticed and that they were proud. So that was great.
Talking with Ben Chan, assistant professor in philosophy, quarterfinalist in this year's Tournament of Champions on Jeopardy. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Have you made some new friends, some new, you know, friends into the future from this experience?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think actually, the two fellows I play tonight, Emmett and Justin, we're texting this morning in anticipation of tonight's airing. Mm-hmm. They're both amazing people. Like, you know, I think I was telling everybody at the TOC recently, like, oh, you know, I'm not sure it feels less that like I found my people than I wandered into a group of really random and cool people, random weirdos who are into this. But it turns out, I think maybe that is my people, is just, you know, a random assortment of people with really interesting lives who happen to be also good at this fun game show.
So this tournament was delayed by last year's Writers Guild of America strike, and guild members write clues for the show. Did that extra wait time give you any type of edge or perhaps even a disadvantage over other competitors?
I think it, if you've seen, actually, I think the top five game winners, I'm number three. The other four have played and the other four have lost. I think what it did was it gave everybody more prep time, which I think closed the gap maybe between the top game winners and the not top game winners. So I think it made for a better competition. Yeah.
So these game shows like Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, they generate millions of dollars in profits each year. Are contestants being paid enough in prizes? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we've talked about that as contestants. We're more, I think, concerned about the bottom end of that, right? And whether it's accessible, right? So one of the things, fortunately, that the producers did this year was raise the prizes in regular season play for the second and third place winners, right? So it had been at $1,000 and $2,000 for 20 years, which will barely cover a trip to Los Angeles, and they raised it to $2,000 and $3,000, which I think, you know, will probably make it so that it's adequate to cover a trip for any contestant who, you know, wants to, you know, needs to take a little time off to fly out to tape. So
yeah,
I think that's probably the biggest concern.
Well, Ben, all the best. Thank you for joining us. Ben Chan, assistant professor of philosophy at St. Norbert College, quarterfinalist at this year's Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Leaked documents may reveal the locations of thousands of microphones used to detect gunshots in major cities, including Milwaukee. We learn about this intelligence that contributes to police response. Call in with a question. You can add your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dhruv Mehrotra is an investigative data reporter for Wired. His report is called "Here Are the Secret Locations of ShotSpotter Gunfire Sensors." Dhruv, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your investigation reveals the location of more than 25,000 of these ShotSpotter sensors. You found more than 100 are in Milwaukee. What is significant about learning the locations of these sensors?
Yeah, well, you know, activists and academics criticize the company SoundThinking, who makes these sensors, basically saying that the tech is inaccurate and it primes police to go into low-income communities of color expecting gunshots when they likely won't find any. So until now, the precise locations of the sensors have been a secret, even from the police departments who contract with the company. So this is the first time we're getting a real window into where the company puts its tech. And you know, what we found is that, you know, more than 12 million Americans live in a neighborhood with at least one ShotSpotter sensor. And you know, in aggregate, nearly 70% of the people who live in a neighborhood with one of these sensors identify as Black or Latina, and nearly 3/4 of the neighborhoods with one sensor are majority non-white.
Can you step back and explain how this technology works, how these sensors operate?
Yeah, you know, on the face of it, the tech is sort of straightforward. You know, the company will work with police departments and install little sensors like microphones on streetlights and traffic signs that are sort of algorithmically tuned to detect gunshots. So when it hears something, when one of these microphones hears something that sounds like a gunshot, and you know, the company calls these impulsive noises, the microphone or the sensor will send an alert to an incident review center, which will then like vet the sound and make sure it was actually a gunshot.
And that fireworks, for instance?
Yes, exactly. And make sure it's not fireworks or something like that. And then they will forward that alert, if it is in fact a gunshot, to dispatchers, who will then send police to investigate the incident.
How does machine learning or AI, is that a piece of this type of technology?
It is. You know, so there's a lot we don't know about how exactly the technology was trained, but the sensors themselves are tuned to sort of detect gunfire. So I believe, you know, they've probably trained these things on the sound of gunfire to be able to, you know, properly discern what is a firework from a, you know, a gun.
And how similar are gunfire detection systems that are provided by other companies? I mean, this is a whole marketplace, I would imagine.
You know, that's a good question. And I can't really tell you. SoundThinking is the sort of most notorious player in this marketplace, and they're certainly the biggest with more, I think, you know, around 160 clients now is what they told me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I actually don't know how their system measures up to other similar gunshot detection systems.
So why is the company secretive about the locations of its sensors?
Well, they say it's to protect both their property, which are the, you know, the sensors themselves, as well as to detect, I mean, as well as to protect the private property of the people who allow them to mount sensors on their property. So the way that this works, according to the company, is that basically, you know, the sensor deployments are not informed by race or anything like that. The company, when they contract with the police department, will ask the department who purchases the system for data about gun violence, which the company says is characterizes as objective. And then they'll recommend a plan for sensor placement. And, you know, once a plan is agreed upon by the department, the company will seek permission from like private property owners, utility companies, and businesses to install these sensors on their premises. So the point of keeping these locations secret is to sort of protect those people who cooperated with law enforcement, as well as to protect the sensors themselves, according to SoundThinking.
I would imagine police departments would have to provide very granular information to this company, ShotSpotter, in order for ShotSpotter to place these detectors, these sensors, in places where there is more gunfire than in other neighborhoods, or, you know, what information might be most helpful for ShotSpotter in this situation?
I mean, the truth is we don't know, right? SoundThinking says it's objective data that they receive from police departments, but without seeing that, quote, objective data, we have no idea. So, you know, I can imagine a situation where, let's say, arrest data is included, and those arrests include drug arrests, right? Those arrests are subject to enforcement bias. So there might actually be some kind of bias that creeps into where the deployments are. So, you know, we just don't know exactly what data SoundThinking uses to inform these deployment plans.
We're talking about this new report from Wired revealing the locations of more than 25,000 gunshot detection sensors. And we have Dhruv Mehrotra, who is an investigative data reporter at Wired. Call in with questions. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Can we talk about patterns? What patterns surface from your analysis of where these sensors are typically being located in communities?
Yeah. So I'd said this earlier, but I can repeat it, though. But so in aggregate, you know, nearly 70% of the people who live in a neighborhood with at least one SoundThinking sensor identify as Black or Latina. Three quarters of those neighborhoods are majority non-white, and the average household in a neighborhood with one sensor earns a little bit more than $50,000 a year. So, you know, the general trend here is that these are low-income communities of color. And, you know, we looked at the sort of data on aggregate, but we also looked in individual jurisdictions, and we found sort of the pattern persists, right? These are placed in typically the poorest and the least white neighborhoods in a jurisdiction.
And then, so your analysis then provides evidence to concerns that these sensors are being primarily placed in low-income neighborhoods and in neighborhoods where the population is predominantly people of color.
That's right. And I think it's important to kind of state the limitation here of this analysis is that, you know, we don't know if so SoundThinking didn't dispute our findings, and SoundThinking also did not dispute the sort of underlying data here. But what they say is that, look, we're putting our sensors in areas that are disproportionately impacted by gun violence. And that's not an analysis that we did. So, you know, I'm hoping that this report adds some context to the debate around this stuff, but there's still more work to be done to figure out what exactly is happening here.
Because critics of this technology say it is disproportionately harming people of color. What do you make of where that debate stands in communities that are grappling with whether to have this technology as part of their community?
Yeah, I think it's very much an ongoing debate, and it all very much depends on the community, right? I've spoken to many people in communities that are impacted by violent crime who don't hate having these sensors around. They want more police there. But I also speak to people who are, you know, they say that when one of these sensors go off, you know, police come running in, you know, they might pick up someone on a bench warrant just because they're in the area where a sensor was. So, you know, they're saying that they are further criminalizing these same communities. So I think the debate is still raging. And I think the debate very much depends on the police department who's deploying these things and how they're going about their policing as well.
Dhruv Mehrotra is an investigative data reporter at Wired, exploring gunfire detection devices and their locations in cities. Call in with a question. You can bring your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security claims improved gunshot detection technology makes American communities of all sizes safer. A new report from Wired reveals secret locations of the gunshot detection system ShotSpotter, including over 100 locations in Milwaukee. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dhruv Mehrotra is an investigative data reporter at Wired. Dhruv, some thinking the company behind ShotSpotter maintains contracts, as you said, roughly with 150 American cities. How much control do city officials or police departments have in where these sensors are placed, where they're located?
That's a good question. It varies. So police departments, when they enter into a contract with SoundThinking, and this is, you know, coming from the company itself, they say that basically the police department suggests, or they provide SoundThinking with, you know, crime data, but they also will suggest like general areas of deployment, and SoundThinking will come up with a plan for deployments that, you know, include like specific, you know, buildings and rooftops and things like that. Police departments don't know the specific buildings. But they do know the general area in which the gunshot detection systems are placed. And certainly they know the areas based on, you know, where they receive alerts. But I think, you know, in terms of precise latitude, longitude coordinates, the police departments apparently don't know where this stuff is.
Do you know how expensive this technology is for cities to maintain? I mean, is it the police budget that is paying for these contracts?
It's millions of dollars. It's an expensive software. It's, you know, can be paid for, but with grants and, you know, city funding as well. But, you know, it sort of varies in every city and based on the deployment itself.
Let's bring on a call. James in Kimberly is here. James, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on and talking about the subject. It kind of goes with kind of line of work I'm in. I work as a paramedic. And it seems to me, I'm feeling that with this technology of this gunfire detection, it's like we're almost kind of behind the ball because, you know, we put these into a community, they detect the gunfire, then the police come down and whoever else, the responders to help with whatever's happening, but then you're already behind the ball because the shots have been fired. It seems to me that, like, if we're going to have some kind of detection device or any kind of thing, we need to be more proactive and try to like not even get to the point where the shots are fired, because even with detection and everything, that's great and you can come in and still help the people, but it's going to be I just feel like we're behind the ball, and is the line of work kind of line of work I'm in, you need to be there right away, or it just doesn't even need to happen.
Upstream, you're looking at upstream interventions that need to happen so that, that the gunfire doesn't take place in the first place. I'm wondering, James, as a first responder, is there this type of technology underway in your community, do you know?
No way. No, don't even know about it. Never even heard about it. And I'm right here, like, in Wisconsin, and I've never even heard about any gunfire detection. The gunfire detection that we know about is people's ears.
James, thank you for that call, which I wonder, Dhruv, you know, how does this technology compare to the speed and accuracy of those 911 calls through dispatch?
Yeah, you know, I think the most recent study out of the DOJ found that compared to 911 calls alone, ShotSpotter alerts bring police to a crime scene faster than with a 911 call. But, you know, crucially, that report also found that the software has no effect overall on public safety. So I think to the listener's point, right, that like perhaps this is like an effective detection tool. It's not actually making any dent on public safety, and it doesn't prevent gunshots from happening in the first place.
It is not lowering the incidence of gun violence overall, although it might lower response times. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what the report found. But it's important to also mention that there are other reports that have found different things. I mean, this software has been studied for by statisticians for years now. So it's I think it really depends on the deployment and who's and sort of the data being used to study the stuff.
Let's bring in Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, what would you like to share?
Microphones are illegal unless the people are notified that they're in the area. They are being abused now. You hear stories all the time that they got microphones in apartments, microphones in houses. Microphones can be abused.
Mary Kay, thank you for that. And it, you know, raises a concern, Dhruv, of how this technology might be used in arrests, in prosecution, in court.
Yeah. You know, the microphones, and, you know, the ACLU has come out and said this as well. But, you know, the ACLU's concerns about these microphones aren't that they're listening. I think they've done some sort of technical analysis to make sure that these things aren't actually being used to eavesdrop on people. The main concern here is that it really over-criminalizes particular areas in a city by drawing police to the area, who then will, you know, either not find evidence of a gunfire or just pick up whoever is on the scene on a misdemeanor or something like that. As well as, of course, there's some high profile incidents of, you know, false arrests because of this stuff. So I think the microphone aspect of this is truly concerning. You're right to point that out. And it sounds concerning on the face of it, but the sensors appear to be tuned for loud, impulsive sounds.
We're talking about this new report revealing the locations of more than 25,000 gunshot detection sensors. Dhruv Mehrotra is an investigative data reporter for Wired. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dhruv, Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson has previously expressed support for his city's use of the ShotSpotter program. How have city officials responded to your investigation about the locations of these sensors? What has the feedback been like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've gotten some requests from city council members in different cities for the data so that they can do their own analysis, which is interesting in itself because, you know, it sort of proves that it's even difficult for city council to get the information that Wired was able to obtain. So I think the response has been largely curiosity. I've seen some feedback that, you know, our report is making the community less safe. And I've seen other reports that sort of, you know, confirm that, you know, like that these sensors are in fact placed in the low income communities in their jurisdiction. And people are saying that cops are showing up and giving people a hard time in the area.
Your investigation says roughly one in every 10 sensors were categorized as broken, unreliable, or out of service last year. What consequences are there for broken sensors?
Yeah, I mean, I think a really dramatic example of this is that in Chicago, a ShotSpotter missed like a 55-round shooting. And, you know, and according to leaked emails obtained by the publication who reported this out, Southside Weekly, the cause of that was broken sensors. So, you know, I think there's a couple risks of broken sensors. One is, of course, that they miss shootings. Another is that they miscategorize shootings. And, you know, something that I hadn't mentioned in all of this is there have been multiple studies, both from, you know, data reporters at local outlets and from, you know, like the Chicago OIG, that basically found that the vast majority of gunshot detections from ShotSpotter don't lead to any evidence of gunfire. As in, police show up and they might search for casings or brass found on the ground, and they can't find any. So I think the efficacy of the software is really unclear at this point.
And that arriving at the scene and being dispatched to chase down perhaps an inaccurate or ShotSpotter alert, I mean, that would take police away from a real pressing call for service, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. And there have been some studies that have found that as well, that it's makes the response to other calls for service much slower.
So as we start to wrap up here, the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 2022 upheld the use of the ShotSpotter system for probable cause searches of people located near a sensor report. How many states allow this technology to be used for probable cause searches? Where is that headed?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that question. What I can say is that the admissibility of ShotSpotter evidence has been challenged in court. And it has both been allowed in court and other judges have found it too unreliable to use. So I've seen it both ways. But as for a count, I don't know.
What are cities doing about their contracts? It seems like Chicago may be taking its ShotSpotter offline later this year. That was the latest report in the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, that's right. Chicago appears to be dropping the software, at least in December, I believe, is when they're going to fully go offline. You know, high-profile cities have come out and said that, look, you know, we don't find that this software is worth the money. Chicago is one of the cities. Let me pull up a list so I don't.
And we're really short on time here, but I just want to thank you for this reporting and thank you for sharing it with us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Dhruv Mehrotra, investigative data reporter at Wired. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Generations of people have made a life on the south shore of Lake Superior and established strong bonds with the Big Lake and bear witness to its shifting landscape. Author Sue Leaf presents her appreciation for this natural wonder and its vulnerabilities from her cabin near Port Wing, where her family has watched the seasons change for over three decades now. The number to be part of this book conversation, it's 800-642-1234. Ask a question, share your thoughts at any point. Email is ideas@wpr.org. Sue Leaf's new memoir is called Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior's South Shore. Sue, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be here.
So as a Minnesota native, your relationship with Lake Superior begins as a child, as does mine in Two Harbors. How would you compare the north and south shores of the lake?
Well, I knew only the North Shore until I took this bike trip with my boyfriend, who would eventually become my husband. The North Shore, for me, I remember wanting to swim in it, in the water when I was a child. And my mother, whose parents both grew up in Duluth, said, no one swims in Lake Superior. And it was beautiful. I loved climbing on the rocks. And I still look forward to any trip we're going to take up there.
I feel that same way. You know, my family would go to this very rustic cabin outside of Two Harbors. And on the way up, I would always like send up this little prayer, like miraculously the lake would warm up so I could go into it. And it was never answered.
No, not on the North Shore. So on the South Shore, Tom suggested that we take this bike trip. He had in mind we would go from Ontonagon to Duluth along the South Shore all the way. And we ended up in Ontonagon close to midnight. Tom put our bikes together right downtown, and then we bicycled out to the campgrounds in the dark and put up the tent. And the next morning, I looked out over the campgrounds to the lake beyond them, and I thought, my goodness, look at all that water. And there's no rocks. It's all a sand beach. It looks like Cape Cod. And that whole day, I was just almost mesmerized by it. And that night when we got into our campsite, we changed into swimsuits and we went down into that water and we went swimming. And it was marvelous.
It's like a totally different body of water.
Except that it was cold. It was quite cold in August in 1970. What was that? 77?
Hmm.
Yeah.
You found a community in Ashland in the 1980s, and you still regret not staying there longer. What did you come to miss about living in Ashland?
Well, we missed the people, first of all. What I missed, which propelled us forward to buy a cabin, was in Ashland, there was always a sense that the sky to the north was lighter than the rest of the sky, even if it was cloudy. And I think that was the sun reflecting off the water. And it just seemed like you were always oriented towards the lake being there. And I missed having that daily kind of a compass to orient by.
You called it Ashland top of the world. I love that. That's just so beautiful. We're talking about the new book, Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. Author Sue Leaf with us. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I wonder about how you talk about the Lake Superior. I mean, I think about all the different ways we say Lake Superior. You heard from how people called it a misunderstood beauty, and that the lake is boss, referring it to, you know, to this, the lake as she. Why do you think that is?
I think, well, the first comment was made by an artist who lives in Ashland, and the second one is a saying that gets passed around, especially among the fishing community in Bayfield. But I think it's more generalized than that. These are people that have a real intimate relationship with the lake, to the point where it's personal, and so I think that's how they can refer to the lake in human terms.
Let's examine vulnerabilities. In 1988, particularly hot summer, then prolonged drought was described by NASA likely due to global warming. What did you understand about global warming at that time?
Well, I actually was aware of global warming. My textbook in college, my ecology textbook, had a sentence or two about the possibility that the atmosphere could warm up and act like a greenhouse. They were calling it the greenhouse effect at that time. And throughout my grad school years, people would talk about it, but we didn't feel any of its effects at that point. But it was always in the back of my mind that something like that could happen. I remember the first time I thought maybe we were witnessing that was due to global warming. And that was when a tornado, a very freak tornado in March, came through and wiped out my college campus.
Hmm.
And I thought, gosh, I'll bet this has the possibility to take down every single place that I love.
How do you find climate change affecting Lake Superior now and that urgency?
Well, the lake is warming.
Mm-hmm.
I just watched a special documentary it's called A Sea Change for Lake Superior. It has algal blooms on occasion now, which it never did, which we have seen on our beaches. The beaches, the lake is more cloudy. The high sea levels of Lake Superior, high lake levels, it's hard to pinpoint them all precisely to climate change, but climate change is definitely a factor in why the lake levels are at record highs. And that is affecting our cliffs, our red clay cliffs, and they are eroding at a rapid pace.
You toured Kakagan Sloughs with Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. Wiggins was on our program in 2022 reflecting on climate change in the Great Lakes.
When you think about climate change, you know, Lake Superior is the fastest warming of all the Great Lakes. There's studies that show by 2060, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan won't even be receiving ice cover, full ice cover. And or ice cover in general. Those are alarming scenarios. And so, you know, we're trying to do our best in real time to put a little bundle of preservation together to send into the future with this place.
What did you learn from tribal leaders about how they treat this watershed and efforts to preserve Lake Superior?
Well, it should be an existential problem for all of us, but for the Ojibwe, they really feel it. Because their whole identity, their call, if you will, to be in this area is based on the lake and the health of the lake. So, yes, Wiggins is right, of course. Mm. And he's got it. He's nailed it. And he knows what the stakes are.
You mentioned the eroding cliff, your cabin near Port Wing, you know, over the more than 30 years. How quickly has erosion, you know, closed the gap between the cabin and the edge of the cliff?
Well, here's what we were told. When we bought the place, the former owners told us that the cliff was eroding at a rate of about a foot per year. And we thought, a foot per year, okay, we can live with that. And over the 30 years or so, the first 30 years, it was about a foot and a half per year, which is still, you know, within the range of acceptability. But then recently we lost 28 feet in 3 years.
Mm.
And we began to see how close the cliff was coming to, for example, our well that's on the lake side of the cabin and then the cabin itself. And we thought, my gosh, this cabin could go into the drink in our lifetime. What are we going to do about that? We also have a marker called, which we call the Red Rock. It's a hunk of sandstone that was out in the water in front of our cabin. When we bought the cabin, we actually stood at the edge of the cliff and looked down on top of the Red Rock. And now the Red Rock is maybe 60 feet out from the cliff.
Hmm.
And that's kind of is an attention gripper. Whenever we have friends come up to the cabin, we take them out to the cliff to show them the Red Rock.
We're talking with Sue Leaf, our guide. New book is called Impermanence, Life and Loss in Superior South Shore. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Author Sue Leaf gives us a glimpse of her relationship with Lake Superior and what binds her to the region. Her new memoir is called Impermanence, and it presents the ongoing complexities of climate change and the environmental threats to the South Shore's watershed. Join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Turning to copper mining now, 6,000 years ago, indigenous people found copper on Isle Royale. They made fish hooks, spear tips from the metal. How quickly did Europeans arrive to mine the copper deposits throughout the region?
Well, they came in the 1840s. And I'm sorry, I don't know when Michigan became a state, but it must have been shortly before that. They came in the 1840s. Douglas Houghton came to check out the deposits, and they hadn't been exploited yet. And he literally found chunks of pure copper on the forest floor. And he came back, and I think within a year or two after Houghton was there, the first prospectors, the first Yankee prospectors were in the area and setting up mines, looking for mines.
So the copper mining boom, it continues for decades. How was the industry affected by the Civil War and changes in extraction methods?
Well, the Civil War actually provided a boon for the copper demand because of, for crazy as it is, brass buttons for the uniforms. And I think telegraph technology needs copper as well. The mines, that's when the Quincy mine and the Hancock mine really came into their own and hired a lot of people. They also lost copper miners to the war effort. Michigan would have had big drives to recruit soldiers for the war, and for like where the Cliff Mine was in Eagle River, they had marches with young men marching down and calling their fellow workers to come join the Union's effort in the Civil War. And you can imagine copper miners, young men in their 20s, would be perfect soldiers. And so they, for that reason, the mine operators, owners started looking to Europe and trying to attract Europeans into the area to run their mines.
And you draw our attention to the first casualty of copper mining being the woods, that the thick forest was no match, you write, for the axes and saws of the mining companies. How has the loss of old growth forests changed the landscape around Lake Superior?
Well, there's a species change, and it's hard for me to appreciate it on a personal level because I've never experienced a large stretch of old growth forest. There is an area on the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula called the Estevan Pines. Really, really big old trees there, both pines and other species. And the first time I visited the Estevan Pines was in early August, many years ago now. And I remember seeing warblers in the pines that I had not seen in our cutover land at the cabin. And I thought, well, yeah, I suppose they attracted old growth warblers like we would not have. You know, there are other wildlife species that would have lived under the trees of the big expanse of forest that can't do so now in remnants.
And you even called the woods on your property damaged goods. The forest around your cabin, what has it endured through time?
Well, it was mostly clear cut around the turn of the last century, in the 1900s. And the loggers left a handful of really big pines, mature white pines and mature red pines, a couple mature red pines. And then it was left by itself. It wasn't replanted or regenerated. And poplars came in, and they spread by root suckers. And so we have many stands of poplar trees, which may in fact be one individual because they share a common root structure, so they probably have the same genetic identity. And then we have balsam fir coming in underneath the poplars, and that will provide a good forest cover for us. Probably not for me, but for my grandchildren.
For your generations.
Right, in the years to come.
So the forest has really had to kind of scramble for itself to do its own reforestation, at least in your area.
To bind up its wounds, right. Mm.
Sue Leaf, new book, Impermanence, as we talk about life and loss on Superior South Shore. Join in 800-642-1234 with your question, your comments. Sue, how do mining tailings and threaten fish populations in Lake Superior today? What is the impact?
Well, you know, the tailings haven't been produced for many years now because the copper industry hasn't been active since World War II. And then it was only on a very limited basis. But the tailings from the stamp sands from the stamp equipment to purify the copper ore so it could be shipped, they were dumped in the lake. And for example, the one I'm thinking of right now is outside of, I think it's Gay, Michigan, that has, it's right on Keweenaw Bay, and it's in a prime spawning area for fish, and the sands, when riled up, can get into the gills of the fish and clog them and literally suffocate small fish. But they also change the chemistry of the water, and it's caused pollution that's very hard for organisms to live in polluted waters.
I was struck by how you write how, as a society, we don't think about how mining stories end. What is that end that we prefer to not think about, that we tend to ignore?
Well, mining is an extractive activity. You have a quantity of resource that you want to use, and you use it up, and then you're left with a big hole in the ground. And that hasn't happened everywhere there's been a mine. And nobody wants to talk about the afterwards, what happens after.
So what evidence of the heydays of copper mining is still evident in, like, the architecture of the towns that you visit along Lake Superior?
Well, of course, the best one is Calumet, Michigan. It's just a remarkable town. It has these gorgeous Richardsonian Romanesque sandstone buildings, many civic buildings, like their fire department. Well, what was the fire department back when it was a mining town? Big, gorgeous churches, an Elks Hall, I think. Downtown businesses are built from these sandstones that were a result of the money made from the mine.
So kind of the legacy of prosperous times in a mining place, but that too shall come to an end at some point.
Right. And you can see this, I mean, in other towns along the shore, like Marquette, Michigan, and Duluth, Minnesota, all have in Superior, Wisconsin, have these nice red sandstone buildings dating from the time when copper, or in the case of Minnesota, iron ore was king.
And you can see how they do stand the test of time, these buildings.
The buildings do, right. Mm-hmm. Mm.
From her cabin near Port Wing, Sue Leaf is taking us on this journey through Lake Superior's South Shore. Her new book is called Impermanence. And you can join the conversation at any point by calling in with a question. You can share your thoughts on the Great Lake, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with author Sue Leaf, whose new book expresses her respect and love for Lake Superior alongside the environmental challenges that take advantage of this natural treasure and its watershed. Her memoir is called Impermanence, and her family cabin is near Port Wing. Call in with the question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, we have a call here of appreciation. Linda Joy from Cribbets called in and says that they got a copy of your book yesterday and want to express that it is so beautifully written and it brings together ideas that people should seriously consider. And I have to say, I really want to elevate Linda Joy there. I agree. How has Lake Superior helped you like live in the moment and see life differently?
Well, I find that I am kind of taken by a horizon. Hmm. That horizons, I think, are soothing, and that they have a kind of a calming effect. And so it allows me to slow down and just think more carefully about what's happening to me and to others and how to live life more gracefully. I'm increasingly feeling hemmed in and crowded when I'm in the mountains now. And I think my mind and how it's working works now under the features of a flat mat, like a prairie or a lake. And so that's what I really like about Lake Superior.
I picture you as a writer on Lake Superior, and I'm just wondering how it might affect your writing process or looking out over the lake.
Oh, I think it makes me a more expansive writer. Hmm. I'm more inclined to see what I'm writing about in big broad terms as being more universal and not just due to me, not just pertaining to me.
We heard from Frank, who has heard that the tectonic plate on the north side of the lake is rising because the ice sheet is leaving and it's tilting the lake. And because of that, yeah, Flooding will happen on the south side of the lake. And Frank is wondering, do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. Actually, it's called isotonic rebound. It's caused, when you think about it, the glacial ice sheets were a mile thick or more, and that's a lot of pressure to put on the surface of the earth. So if you think of pressing down on a marshmallow, how the marshmallow compresses, but if you raise your hand off the marshmallow rebounds back. Mm-hmm. That's in a very small way what's happening to our land now as the glacier is receding. And of course, it happened first on the south shore and now on the north shore. And so the north shore is actually rising with respect to the south shore. So if you think about it, it's like the whole basin of Lake Superior is tilting slightly to the south. And so the water tilts with it and flows into the creeks and into the along the cliff. And in fact, my son, who is a geologist, takes a look at the St. Louis Bay estuary by Duluth and Superior and says, that looks like a flooded estuary to me, to my eye, because the water is tilting in towards the rivers and the inlets of that area.
What might that mean for the shoreline and what you see happening to shoreline?
Right. So even if there wasn't increased rainfall into the basin because of climate change, the water would still be eating at the toe of our cliff because of that isotonic rebound.
With the water lapping like that, what have your neighbors tried to do to hold up, you know, the cliff? You talked about how they've tried to shore it up and stabilize the bluff.
This is a very sad story, right? Our neighbors did not have a cliff that was quite as steep as ours, but it was steep. And they hired heavy equipment to come in and minimize that angle to the water. And then they planted it with grasses. They also hauled in huge boulders to prevent the waves from the water hitting the cliff and eating away at its toe. And they laid down hardware cloth, really sturdy, indestructible type of fabric before they put these big rocks down. So it was quite an obvious
engineering feat. Yes.
Right. Engineering feat, but also an obvious change to what they looked out on. Mm. And today those big rocks are about 10 feet out in the water. It didn't slow it down, I don't think. And it certainly didn't work. And they've marred that portion of the beach of Lake Superior by their efforts. It's just, it just is not possible, I think, to actually have much effect on this very big ecosystem level phenomenon.
Sue Leaf is our guide to Lake Superior. New book is called Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. And you can join the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, we're going to turn to bobbing, ice fishing.
Okay,
here we go. You have some choice words about these bobbers. What do you think about bobbers and the people who venture out on the ice to fish?
What I thought when I first heard of bobbers and when I first saw them in action in 1983 was I thought these guys are nuts. Okay, so in case for people who don't know what a bobber is, we're not talking about those little white and red spheres that you attach to a fishing line to catch panfish that are so exciting to watch going to under. We're talking about fishermen who are out to catch really big lake trout. And the lake trout hang out in deep water. So you have to get away from the shore far enough to reach a place where the lake is 200 feet deep. So in order to do that, you walk far out into the ice or take your snowmobile out far into it. But the catch is along the shoreline, unless the lake is totally frozen over, which almost happens like never, the ice is not secure. And so it might stay in place while you're out there, or it might break off. And so bobbers run the risk of having the ice that they're on break off and start to float away.
Floating island.
Yes, cracks between the shore ice in close and the other ice can widen to the point where your snowmobile isn't going to jump over it. But even think about this. If you're making your snowmobile jump over it, I mean, that itself is frightening. So they go out there and they can spend a day out in the deep, on the deep end fishing. And some where they can tell when the water when the ice is drifting, because the current that their lines are subjected to seems to be shifting. But of course, currents don't shift. They're set at least for the day, and that indicates that you are in fact the ones that is drifting. Okay, so that's why I thought they were crazy, because I thought, why would you risk your life just for a big fish? And they don't even eat these fish. Most of the fish, big fish, are considered old fish, and they're good breeders. And so a lot of big fish get the picture taken and they get released back into the water.
So you call up Greg Alexander, the bobber and emergency medical technician.
Right, he's a perfect resource because he sees the danger, but he also is caught up in this idea of the excitement of bobbing.
And he carries two pairs of ice picks. What are they used for?
Ice picks are this device with a nail coming out of each, like a cylinder of wood that you can hang around your neck, and if you happen to get put into the ice, you take the nails and you can get a purchase onto the ice to get yourself back out of the water and onto the ice. We always have them around our necks when we go skating on our lake. As a standard piece of equipment, and Greg carries two, one for himself and one to give away.
One to give away to a bobber who might not be carrying one.
Right, who might need his services.
Oh, wow. And they also tap the ice from time to time with these ice rods. What are they listening for?
They Well, I don't know if they can, they probably can hear of the thickness, but they're waiting for the point at which the rod goes through the ice, which indicates them the ice is too thin to hold them. And then they back up from there and drill their hole. You know, I do want, before we leave the bobbing portion, I do want to point out that I've changed my opinion of bobbers because think, you know, when you meditate on what it's like out on the ice of Lake Superior, once again, there's a horizon and it's a wilderness out there, but it's a wilderness that's always changing because the winds are changing, because the weather changes, storms come in. And so for people who want to test themselves under wilderness conditions, this is one of the last true wildernesses part in the area. And so it's to know yourself in the way that you get to know when you have a wilderness experience, that you can get it when you're bobbing.
It's just amazing to think of that, a wilderness experience out on this expansive frozen lake is like being all alone in a real wilderness. It takes the word in new directions.
Well, yes, but think about it. In a real wilderness, like the Boundary Waters canoe area,
yes,
people have cell phones. People see a lot of people. When you're in the Boundary Waters canoe area, the portages are well packed. The tree roots are exposed. The campsites are worn. There's a lot of people that pass through that quote-unquote wilderness. In the bobbing world of the wilderness is new every day.
Author Sue Leaf, our guide to appreciating the ever-changing wonders of Lake Superior South Shore, new book, Impermanence and Their Space to Talk. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get an intimate look at the pulse of the seasons on Lake Superior South Shore and the climate threats that will change how future generations interact with the watershed. Author Sue Leaf's new book is called Impermanence. Her family cabin is near Port Wing, and you can call in with a question. Share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, let's turn to your friends, the birds. During your summers on the South Shore, what have you observed about the migratory habits of birds?
Well, we have had shorebirds coming through in early August that I know they're already flying south, which is a common understanding, but we could see it personally. I had a Baird sandpiper, a couple of them, right on our shore one August day. I was reading in on the beach, and the birds came in and right next to me. You could tell they were exhausted. They were sleeping the entire time, very close to me, just maybe too weary to be afraid of a human being. We see other shorebirds, like at the harbor at Port Wing on the sandy beaches, that come in on their migration. I really like warblers, and we have warblers nesting in our woods. We have Nashvilles, and we have magnolias and red starts, and we can tell when they go. And I think the immatures of the year go after the adults do. So the woods seem to be emptying. The woods are very quiet right now. We've also found that our eagles did not migrate this year. That they were the most obvious birds we had in the woods the entire time were the eagles.
Well, what might be causing these changes?
Well, you know, birds migrate because they don't have enough food to eat, not because it gets too cold. Mm. And as long as the lake remains open and the eagles have access to the fish there and also to roadkill, there's no reason for them to undertake the stress of migration and leave their home property.
Let's listen to the sound of a piping plover, and you call these shorebirds winsome. And that's courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. How have piping plovers fared along the South Shore?
Their numbers were greatly reduced, mostly because the beaches that they don't build much of a nest. It's very hard to actually identify a piping plover nest. They essentially lay their eggs right on the sand. So if the beach where they decide to lay their eggs is heavily trafficked by human feet, or by an increase in predators, they're not going to have success in reproducing. And they are prey to both people who walk the beach, people's dogs who walk the beach with them, and predators like skunks and raccoons, whose numbers have increased as the human population present has increased near the lakes. They were down to a very few breeding pairs, and those only off the coast of, or the shoreline of Lake Michigan, kind of by Sleeping Bear Dunes, and but they had been seen in the past on Superior South Shore, and they are now breeding again on like Long Island,
mm-hmm.
And also some of the other Apostle Islands. I think Outer Island maybe had a pair.
There's a really earnest build back program for these birds on the Apostle Islands.
Yes, because they're an endangered species. Mm. And once they're listed on the endangered species, under the Endangered Species Act, you have to have a plan for bringing them back to a stable population.
And so the scientists will camp out and will follow these birds by day and document the pairs and what is happening to each. Can you explain a little bit about that attention to these particular piping plovers?
Well, yes, they camp out. They have a camp, and they spend 1 week intervals out there. They bring their drinking water out, and they have to monitor the nests. These are usually like biology majors or recent graduates from college. And one of them told me that he had read a lot of books that summer by himself. They monitor the fate of each nest. They map out the territory of each bird. So they're getting a lot of just basic natural history. You know, that's true for most of the birds. We just don't know a whole lot about them. And you have to, in order to get them to recover, you have to know as much as you can. And they're having success in their nesting, and the young are coming back the next year to nest themselves.
There's an unsettling word or phrase in your book, unusable winter, and you say global warming is pushing the region closer to experiencing unusable winter. What do you mean? Yeah, what do you mean by that?
By unusable winter, I mean ice storms, freezing rain, slush, snow that you can't groom for a cross-country ski trail, a slushy lake that you can't skate on. Living in Missouri, where you have to endure frozen water in frozen form, but you can't play on it.
Hmm. You have thought about the time that might come when cross-country skiing is no longer an option or an option for the span of winter. What is coming up for you?
Well, I have a child that lives in Madison, and it's hard for him to train for like cross country ski races, at least on snow, because the snow doesn't hang around. But I think I remember a time when Madison had plenty of snow, and it's just the winters are getting too warm to have the lasting snow cover. Hmm.
Let's land on your cabin transition. You took down your old cabin, built a new one farther from the eroding cliff. How has that been for you, that change?
Well, actually, the old cabin is still standing.
Oh, it's still standing.
Yes, okay. Because it has white pine paneling inside that we need to get someone in there to take it off so it doesn't go into the landfill.
Okay.
And when we do that, I'll be ready to see it go. I thought it would be wrenching, but, you know, our new cabin is so wonderful. And the old cabin seemed almost immediately to have lost its soul as soon as we were out of it. And the mice took over. The new cabin is small. It is at least as small as the old cabin was, maybe smaller. It has a lot more windows in it, and it's heated with in-floor heating, so that and it's tight, so we have no mice in it. So that's a huge improvement.
And it's very special that your architect daughter designed it.
Yeah, it was. She was great with her clients. And I have, she gave me a little writing room where I, you know, this is going to sound terrible, but I didn't care as much about looking at the lake as I did about getting constant sunshine. Because if my writing desk was in a place that was going to be in the dark, you know, during the day, I don't think I would have sat there. I would have just taken my pencil and pad of paper and gone somewhere else. So yeah, we just came back from the cabin yesterday, and it's really fun to see the woods and snow. And we had tracks of what I think was a bobcat going down our driveway, and the bobcat seemed to follow my husband's snowshoe trail all over the place. So we were actually making the bobcat's life a little bit easier.
Oh, well, Sue, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Sue Leaf is author of Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior's South Shore. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.